So you've done inner child work, but have you really? I thought I did until my abandonment wounds came back and completely kicked my ass. So shit shows, I want to hit you with three quick truth bombs about inner child work that I've come to learn the hard way. Okay, so number one, you can't reparent yourself from the neck up. You can't think your way into safety. If your body still feels tense, reactive, or numb, that's your inner child telling you the work hasn't reached them yet. Number two, talking to your inner child isn't enough. You have to feel what they felt. And number three, reparenting has to be somatic to actually work. Safety isn't something you say, it's something you practice. And that is what breathwork gives us, a felt sense of safety the younger you never got to experience. And that is exactly why I'm offering Breathe to Heal, a somatic journey to reclaim your inner child. It is a 6-week course starting on August 13th, run by fellow shit show and somatic and breathwork practitioner Teresa, where we are combining breathwork, somatic practices, parts work, and community healing at the steal of the cost of most somatic courses, let me add. Spots are limited. Don't sleep on this shit. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. That is adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. Trust me, this is the work that actually works. What if the most painful part of your childhood wasn't what happened, but what didn't? My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show, and I am an adult child. And if you're wondering, what the hell does that mean? No, it is not a child living in an adult's body. It is someone who is still carrying the emotional wounds of a chaotic, dysfunctional, or traumatic childhood. And usually without even realizing it. There are millions of adult children out there who don't realize they're an adult child. I used to be one of them. And that's why I created this damn podcast where we unpack everything that being an adult child entails and how the hell to heal from it in a raw and vulnerable and at times humorous way. We don't pretend to have it all together here. We give it to you straight. We embrace that this healing journey is often a shit show, and by we, I mean me. So welcome aboard this hot mess of a ship. We curse here, you have been warned. So today, folks, we are revisiting an episode with trauma coach, writer, friend of the pod, you know where you love her, Laura K. Connell. I've had her on a few times, but this was her first appearance on the show. And we are taking a look at when the most painful part of your childhood wasn't what happened, but what didn't, about what it's like to wake up to that kind of invisible trauma later in life and the shame of not having a quote unquote good enough reason to feel so broken, the rage that surfaces when you finally stop minimizing and just the grief and all the emotions that hit you when you realize that your parents are never going to change. I might have a little experience with that. We are also talking about self-sabotage, also something I have no experience with, and how it is often a form of self-protection. We're getting into inner child healing and going no contact with a parent. So let's get on with the damn show, shall we? Let's get on with the damn show. But first, let's talk about, let's talk about how last day, this is, if you're listening to this on July 9th, tomorrow, the 10th, is the last day to get on this early bird pricing for this Breathe to Heal workshop course, 6-week course that is something that you really want to participate in, okay? Spots are going fast, and I'm not just saying that, so don't sleep on signing up. Next, let's talk about why you need to damn the doing shit show, my online support community, where there are a minimum of 6 weekly support groups that you can participate in, where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal, who also don't pretend like they have it all together. This is one of the most vulnerable places on the planet. All that shit that you're afraid to say out loud, that you're afraid that people are going to judge you, they're not going to get you. This is the place where you can come and people are not only going to not judge you or shame you, they're going to be like, yeah, hell yeah, me too. Me too. So you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, and I know that there are hundreds of you, if not thousands. How about today's the day? How about you get off that damn shame raft and hop on this healing ship for less than $1 a day? I think that's a steal, folks. See the link in the bio, or you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshownext. Give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at adultchildpod. I last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. And yeah, that's you that's also been listening for like years and has yet to give me a damn 5-star review. Yes, you. Please. Thank you. Love you all.
Well, it was my pleasure to introduce, do I need to say the K? Laura K. Connell? Do we need
you know what's Laura funny? K? The only reason I have that is because when I went to get the website domain, LauraConnell.com was taken. So I just put my middle initials.
Who is the other Laura Connell?
I don't know. I think it's something in finance or something like that. Nothing to do with what I do. So I just threw the K in there. So it's up to you whether you say it.
We'll get rid of the other Laura Connell. She's just not deserving. So Laura K. Connell, she is a trauma-informed coach. She's an upcoming author. You guys are going to love the title of her book. It's called It's Not Your Fault. Well, first of all, you're from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I might have an O Canada moment, which is like if I ever interject with just like a really random comment, that's called my O Canada moment. Because I was talking to a Canadian, she started talking and then I just interrupted her and I was like, oh, you're from Canada, right? So do you like to sit in, do you like maple syrup baths and you eat poutine and watch hockey?
That's exactly my whole life.
Yeah. Are you a huge hockey fan?
You know, I'm not. I'm really not. But sometimes I feel just by being born in Toronto that I have to be a Leafs fan. It's kind of in your blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine. Okay. So how the hell did you get here?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I was talking to you a little bit about being in the 12-step program and getting sober 12 years ago.
Had you tried to get sober before? Or was that your first time trying?
I had tried on my own, but it wasn't true sobriety. It was the old sit on your hands, white knuckle, that kind of thing. And the best I did was I did 5 months like that, 5 months without a drink on my own. But like I said, it just, there was none of the change that you get with a true sobriety program, right? So after that 5 months, I ended up relapsing, of course. And it was that relapse that made me realize that, yeah, I really can't stop on my own. Like I can't, and I need help. And that was when I went ahead and got the help that I needed.
When did alcohol become a problem for you?
You know what? I started when I was like 16, 17. And it was really a response to what was going on at home. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a very chaotic household. I had a lot of emotional abuse and neglect. I would say I developed the dreaded, fearful, avoidant attachment style, if you know anything about attachment styles. Mm-hmm. And so I just really felt very alone in the world, very fearful. I was definitely in survival mode, survival brain. So I never thought about kind of the long-term consequences of things. I just needed to do what I had to do right now to stay safe.
Fearful avoidant is disorganized?
The same. Yeah.
How do you feel about condiments?
Condiments? Mm-hmm. Like ketchup and stuff? Huh. It's funny because I used to be almost addicted to ketchup, but since I've kind of given up sugar, I don't really use it. But hot sauce is essential to me.
So I have this theory that anxious attachers, they love condiments. They use a lot of condiments. Yeah. And avoidance don't, or maybe they like a little bit of mustard, but I've been like conducting this research for like a year now. And it's like 85% true. I don't have a theory for disorganized.
Right. Yeah, definitely hot sauce is my big one.
And so when was the moment that you really realized that you had an issue with alcohol?
Gosh, I think I realized I had an issue with alcohol for most of the time I was drinking. But it's funny that whenever I would ask someone I knew whether they thought I had a problem, they would always reassure me that I didn't, you know, because all the people I surrounded myself with were drinking a lot too. Yeah. So they didn't want someone questioning that, right? And so I can remember things like asking my best friend, you know, do you think I drink too much? Do you think I have a problem? She'd go, just the fact that you're asking that means you don't have a problem.
No, know? Just the fact that you are asking that means you do have a problem. Right?
Yeah. So, you know, and I think it really ramped up when I have two children. And after I had my second child, I think it really ramped up just because I was dealing with a ton of emotional neglect from my husband, who is the avoidant attachment style because of his own childhood issues. His family was very dysfunctional. My family was severely dysfunctional. So just being in this position of having two little kids and really feeling totally unsupported, totally unequipped, it just kind of drove me to escape into the drink even more. So that's when it really ramped up, when I was in my 30s, I would say.
And did you get sober before you got divorced?
Right after, interestingly enough. Yeah, my husband was a drinker too. I can't say whether he's an alcoholic or a functioning alcoholic. I don't know, but he was a daily drinker. And yeah, as soon as I got out of that, within a year, I'd been married for 11 years and with him 7 before that, for so like my whole adult life. As soon as I got out of it, I started to look at myself honestly. And within a year, I was in the 12-step program.
And so did you hit an adult child bottom in sobriety?
That's an interesting question. What do you mean by that?
Well, so for me, at 9 years sober, you know, I hit a, well, 7 and 9 years sober, I just hit a horrible emotional bottom in which I finally came to terms with the true impact that my childhood had on me. It was like, for me, I feel like I had to get sober. And, you know, like we say, how trauma comes up when your body and your psyche knows that you're ready to handle it. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was through sobriety, after I got, you know, kind of solid in that arena, that stuff really started to come to the surface for me. Mm-hmm. And so for years, I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. And it was at 7 and 9 years sober is when I finally like had that aha moment and realized the true impact that my childhood had on me. Granted, I had always known that it was less than ideal, but I had been clueless to the fact that what I experienced in dating was complex PTSD.
Mm-hmm. I can relate to that. It's actually quite recent that I have made the link between my childhood trauma and what I was doing to myself as an adult. It's been probably within the last 5 years, I would say, that I've made that connection.
Right at the right time. That's when it happens, is usually between 5 to 10 years sober is like when that stuff comes up.
That makes sense. Yeah. And I think that's one thing. I'm kind of ambivalent about the 12-step program. Like, I'm neither for or against, but I can see the things that it's lacking is that insight into how our past trauma affects our current outcomes, right? And so I didn't get that in the program for sure. I got that with my own investigation, and I can't even remember what really brought me to it, but I think it was just a continuous looking at myself and kind of asking questions about why I was doing what I was doing. Kind of in the same way I would ask myself why I can't stop drinking, just getting really curious about it. And I start to notice things like not following through on projects and feeling like it's really impossible to complete this. Like, I'm always going for the next shiny object. And this is more than procrastination. Like, you know how people joke about procrastination, it's no big deal, everybody does it. But this was different. This felt like something that I had no control over. And so I started to learn how even that was related to childhood trauma. because the dangers of visibility, you know, how much I was hiding, not wanting to be seen. So I had to overcome all of that.
Well, it's all self-sabotage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's interesting. So you don't, huh? So there wasn't like a one aha, big aha moment.
You know what? If there was, I can't think of it right now. It feels more like something that happened gradually.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps if I thought about it a little more, it might come to me, but you know,
well,
right now,
let me know if you think of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what were you doing professionally at that point?
Pretty much everything I didn't want to do. In a nutshell, I was doing things that, you know, really didn't use my talents or skills. I was doing like administrative stuff. I was working in offices as assistants to other people. You know, I was doing what I needed to get benefits for my kids, which is, you know, valid, but it was also kind of an excuse not to pursue the things that I wanted to. So I didn't really trust myself enough to pursue the things I was good at, even writing. I've always been a writer and I've always done that on the side, but I didn't pursue it full force until really a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
So at the time I was just basically doing office work.
I was stalking you on your website and I like went back to like your very, very earliest blogs and it's all about decluttering.
Yes, that was a huge part of my journey, to be honest. Decluttering my space led to decluttering my mind. You know, it's kind of a cliche, but it really is true. That led to all the investigation I started to do internally. And so you might see the blogs back at that time are a lot more kind of vanilla than the intensity of the ones as you go forward more. And that's part of my trajectory. And part of that was that I didn't want to reveal all this stuff about myself and about how I felt, because I had been so shamed in the past by the people in my life. Anytime I tried to be emotionally honest, it just wasn't accepted. And I was very vilified for that. So to protect myself, I really kept all that under wraps.
Uh-huh.
And like I said, until about 2 years ago, and I think the pandemic had something to do with this, you know, it made a lot of people, including myself, rethink things. And I just felt like I'm not going to hide anymore. You know, I'm just going to tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may.
That was one way that might, because I think that with the clutter and stuff, it's just like a way of creating unmanageability in a way for our outsides to represent what we're feeling on the inside. So I had that too. I wouldn't say I wasn't like hoarder status, but like if you like opened up closets or drawers, like it was a fucking nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
I got like a professional organizer to come over, turn another gal, and they just took everything out. She reorganized everything for me. And God, what a difference that made when I would like walk into my apartment and sit in my space. She's actually writing a book now, but kind of more on like the psychology behind it and just all the experiences that she's had going into these people's homes and looking at the trauma aspect of it as well. So I'm going to have her on, which I'm excited about. But God, it's so hard to feel good about yourself, like when you're walking into a nightmare, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really interesting too, that there's, when we clutter and hoard, there's all these things that we don't want to look at. Like I can remember that feeling of there being a drawer or a closet and I'm just like, I don't want to look at that. And it's such a parallel to how we don't want to look at things in ourselves, you know, one really does impact the other. And as soon as I started like just looking at every single thing I owned and asking whether it belongs in my life or not, that had such a huge impact. You know, it started helping me to set boundaries and ask the same question about the people in my life, the things I was doing, you know, it was huge.
It's like the same thing with like making appointments for the dentist or like, you know what I mean? Like you just like put it off.
Yeah. And that's something I still struggle with, you know, that's the adult child in me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, adult things are hard. Still trying to figure it out. So prior to you having this kind of revelation that your, you know, self-sabotaging behaviors were connected to your childhood, what was your understanding of your childhood?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that as a child, I'm not sure I really knew anything was wrong, because I hear these stories of children who are in these terrible households and they have this cognizance that these people are crazy, you know? And I didn't have that. I think I always thought something was wrong with me. And that just might be my personality, because they say some people internalize.
It's safer. It's not safe for us to think that our parents are the problem, because they're the ones that are taking care of us. So it's easier for us to think that we're the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is safer, like you say, because you don't want to admit that these people who are responsible for you actually don't care that much about you, you know? So the very first incident I can remember that kind of changed me, and I got to this by reading a book by Mastin Kipp. Have you heard of him?
Yep.
Yeah. And he had this book called Claim Your Power. And he talks a lot about these issues that you and I are talking about today. And he calls it the inciting incident. And he says it's something that happened to you probably early in childhood, and it kind of changed everything. And so for me, I feel like that happened when I was like 3 years old, and my mother was on the phone, and I was like trying to get her attention. I was jumping up and down, you know. I probably in my young mind didn't really have any idea what the phone was or how she was using it or whatever. I just knew that I wanted her attention. And after a couple minutes of this, without any warning, she just reaches over and smacks me across the face. And that had a huge impact on me. First of all, when I think back on that, I can't believe that I ever acted like that, like a kid who was trying to get attention and was flamboyant, because I became so the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. And that incident sounds kind of innocuous or maybe not that big of a deal, but the impact was huge, and it really did change me. And I did become a child who was very quiet, very withdrawn, very shy. And so kind of reclaiming that three-year-old has been part of my job.
Somebody has shared a very, very similar, I don't know who it was, but like almost the exact same story, that they were trying to get their parents' attention while they were on the phone. And they, I think they threw something at them.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And the lack of communication there, and sort of the idea that I should be reading her mind even when I'm a little kid, and that it's all about her needs. So that was kind of the climate in the household. My mother was the most toxic person. She was, you know, I've talked to therapists who suggested she might have had borderline personality disorder, but some kind of undiagnosed mental illness, right? She was not capable of empathy or compassion, and just very narcissistic. And so that was the source of a lot of my pain. And then on the other side, my father was very withdrawn. He was emotionally neglectful. So he just didn't do anything to protect me. He was just kind of a ghost almost. Like he was a body, but he was just kind of not really there in any other way except the physical. I don't even remember him really looking me in the eyes or anything like that. Do you know what I mean? So that was the climate. And I can't stress enough, and when I tell people sometimes they can't believe it, I can't stress enough how neglected and rejected I was. Like just never hearing a kind word, never hearing an encouragement, never hearing good job, you know, never getting any guidance on what to do. And so those things really shaped me. And of course, you know, led to the coping mechanisms such as the drinking.
Did you have siblings?
Yeah, I had one sibling. Yeah. And it's really interesting because she went kind of the opposite way. And as you know, siblings have very different experiences, right? And I think with her, whereas I became the people pleaser and the low confidence and the fearful avoidant, She actually became someone who set out to get her needs met. So I think she kind of said, I need to take care of myself. And now she's the one with the very rigid boundaries. You know, she's the avoidant attachment. She's got very good confidence, you know, so we had very different reactions to the abuse we were treated to in the home.
Have you guys been able to have conversations about this? Like, since you've been,
no, she won't have any emotional conversation. And anytime I've kind of, I mean, not even the least little bit, anytime I've tried to elevate a conversation above really small talk, it's been met with a death stare and the silent treatment. She just will not go there. So for that reason, we don't have a lot of contact. I'm not no contact, but I don't really hear from her and I don't really instigate conversation. She lives in England, so there's not really a lot of opportunity to see each other unless we put forth the effort. And I kept in touch with her because of my kids who are now adults. And when the youngest turned 18, I kind of washed my hands of it. I said, you can have that relationship now if you want it. And I questioned myself whether I even should have done that, you know, because I found I would maintain these relationships that were really bad for me for the sake of my kids. And I don't know if that was the right thing to do. I think that might be a regret that I have. Mm-hmm. Because they saw me with these people who brought out the worst in me, you know, and I'm not sure that that was the right thing to do for them.
Yeah. And perhaps like showing them you accepting mere crumbs in relationships.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 100%.
Love those crumbs. Mm-hmm. So did you have a slew of like toxic relationships before your husband?
You know what? I was one of those who attracted good guys and pushed them away because I didn't think I deserved them. So honestly, I didn't have a lot of toxic relationships. My marriage was pretty toxic, but mainly because he was so emotionally avoidant and I was so emotionally messed up, you know. But I have to say, I met him when I was 19, so there wasn't even a lot of time to have relationships beforehand. But I did have one, my first real boyfriend in high school, that was quite toxic. And I'd say that was turning abusive when I finally ended it. He was starting to become kind of scary. So I think it would have gotten physical if I didn't end it there. And I have to say that that's one thing I would thank my father for. He was never physically abusive. And I think that is one of the reasons why I wouldn't tolerate that. Because I know that a lot of women who do get into physically abusive relationships, it's because what they've received from their fathers or seen their fathers do to their mothers, right? And because that wasn't my experience, I didn't tolerate it.
Mm-hmm. So was it difficult for you, like as you're kind of discovering, you know, the stuff about yourself and having new insights and perspective on your childhood? Was it hard for you to grasp that what you had experienced was trauma?
Yeah, I think because I had blamed myself for so long and other people in my life had blamed me too. You know, I'm a Generation X and we grew up in a time where whatever, it's all about your choices. You know, you just made bad choices and everything in your life is a result of what you've done. And that's your fault. That's the culmination of the choices you've made. There's nobody else to blame. And finding out that that's totally untrue and how deep this stuff goes, being able to say that I went through trauma is easy now, but it did take some time to get there because I thought of trauma as something worse, especially because I didn't have physical abuse as part of my experience. And I was having a lot of trouble explaining to people because I grew up in a time where even emotional abuse wasn't really considered abuse. Even that is quite recent, maybe in the last 10 years or something. So to say, you know, it's just so deep and it's something that you feel at a cellular level. So even trying to give examples of things, often it's what your parents did not do that hurt you more than what they did. So, you know, I remember trying to make my mother understand, which of course I've given up on now, but at the time I thought I could. And she said, well, I don't know what your problem is. I didn't abuse you. I never hit you. And part of me was like, yeah, so what is my problem? You know, and it's the emotional neglect that I think is probably the worst.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you don't know that it's in there. Mm-hmm. And that I think even leads to more shame and more feeling like there's something inherently wrong with us because we feel like something that bad didn't really happen. You know, like, mm-hmm. why am I this screwed up when my parents never hit me?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And just finding out, I think the internet has helped a lot, you know, because you can just go online and you can see what other people are talking about and realizing that it's not normal for your parents to never say a kind word to you. You know, it's not normal for your parents to not praise you when you get an award or do a good job. Those are just real baseline things that every parent should do. So yeah, just finding out that, or just acknowledging that the way I was raised was not normal. It was not okay. And it really had a deep impact on me.
Mm-hmm. And so what did that process look like of, well, I guess one, what did the process look like of coming to terms with the fact that it wasn't your fault?
Yeah, I think it was really learning from people like Dr. Gabor Mate about, you know, he's pretty strict on his opinion that he thinks all addiction is a result of childhood trauma. And I don't know if that's true 100%, but I love that he says it because it really is validating and it makes you see that, well, it isn't your fault, you know, and these things that we went through, I mean, we had to cope somehow, you know. I just found that being in reality was just too hard and feeling unsupported was just too hard. So yeah, coping in any way I could was how I got through it.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk a lot about like self-abandonment, mm-hmm. what would you say are some really subtle ways that people are abandoning themselves that they might not realize that it's self-abandonment?
Yeah, I would say there is a very natural response for those of us who have grown up with childhood trauma, and that is to not ask first what's good for me. We tend to have this external focus because of the way we were raised, that the first thing we ask is, how can I please that person? Mm. How can I stay safe by making sure they're happy? And we do it by just letting down, you know, not even asking the question, what do I want here? That might feel just so unnatural. We never even do it, you know? And it could even be, you know, if you're in a social situation, you tend to read neutral expressions as negative. You know, somebody could just have kind of a normal expression and you feel like they don't like you or they're mad at you, and you do whatever you can to kind of get them on board or get them to like you. And there's the thing that I used to do where you're always the listener. You know, you're always listening while someone else is always talking. You're not offering a lot of information about yourself. And in this way, people don't really get to know you, right? So the self-abandonment that we do in these ways, it's not only not helping you get your needs met, it's really dishonest because it is not helping other people get to know you. And I say in some of my blogs and in the book that healthy people detect this dishonesty and it makes them not trust you. Mm. So then you might feel that rejection and it kind of fuels the, ugh. You know, see, I'm not lovable. See, people don't like me. But in reality, it could be just them sensing something's kind of off because you are not communicating in an honest way. And it's important to say that's not your fault, which is what I always say, but it is something that you might want to be mindful of and take steps to improve or change.
Well, that's what's so hard with all of this stuff is just like the self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like how yeah. that, like, and climbing out of that, it's like so challenging.
Mm-hmm. It really is, because the dreaded social situations can really set you back. You know, I used to do a lot of the socializing thinking I've got to get out, I've got to make connections. But the way I was socializing wasn't helping me make connections, because I was really just people pleasing and self-abandoning. So I think that, yes, we need people, but I think first you got to have that connection with yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to really tune into who you are and what you want before you can start trying to connect with other people.
What were some surprising things that you learned about yourself as you went through this journey?
That's a great question. I think some surprising things would be my strength. You know, I think I never thought of myself as a strong person. And I can remember people telling me I was a strong person. And I just thought, you know, I had the imposter syndrome. I thought they were just mistaken or I was doing a good job of acting. But I realize now, looking back at the way I was raised, it's like I wonder that I'm alive, really, you know, because my ACEs score is 6, my resilience score is 1, and those are really bad odds, you know. And so even the fact that I'm here makes me realize how strong I am. And the other surprising thing is learning that there's been no downside to exposing myself. Telling the truth about what I've been through has only connected me to more people. It's really created this huge audience of other people who have been going through the same thing and who always say, I love that you help me feel like I'm not alone. And they do the same thing for me. So even now, if I sometimes, you know, the holidays are really hard for me. It's a very lonely time. I'm not really in touch with most of my family, except for my kids, of course. And so it's just a lonely time. And I went into my email and there were all these responses to an email I had sent to my list, and just so heartwarming, and just about how they're going through the same thing that I am. And that really lifted me up, you know? So that's been a wonderful surprise.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. What does your relationship look like with your parents?
I haven't had contact with my mother for a while, and that was
a long
time coming.
Did they stay together?
No, they got divorced when I was, well, you know, because they were so chaotic, they didn't end up getting divorced till I was 16, but they broke up multiple times before that. My father moved out when I was 7, then he moved back in, then they separated again. So I never knew what was going on. And they never told us about it. Like, I would just wake up and be like, oh, where's dad? You know, that kind of thing. So I think about how when I got divorced, how we sat our kids down and we told them exactly what was going to happen, and we talked them through it and everything. And to look at the way my parents dealt with it, it was just insane. Yeah, so my mother, that's been very hard, very damaging. And so we would go through these things where she would disown me, usually because I had said something she didn't like, or I didn't do something she wanted me to do. And then she would come back like nothing had happened, and I would just take her back, you know? And so that was a pattern for years. And then finally, one day, it might have been because I got sober, I'm not sure, because it's been a little while, but I finally was like, no, I'm not going to take you back. You know, I didn't say that to her, but I think I'm not sure if I didn't answer, or I sent an email that said, I'm not willing to put up with this anymore, that kind of thing, which really enraged her. But then eventually she offered for us to go to counseling. That made me very hopeful. We went to counseling together, and I got to have a witness to what she's been putting me through. And she just went ballistic during one time. The therapist invited me to just kind of bring up a topic that I wanted to discuss with my mother. And I remember thinking, you don't know what you're asking, you know, like she's going to lose it. And the therapist looked so happy. And she was like, you know, come on, let's discuss it. And I was like, okay. And I just said one little thing. My mother completely lost it. She ran out of the room screaming. And the therapist said to me, I think your mother needs some individual counseling. And that was kind of honestly the last time I really had contact with my mother. And since then, she sent gifts, which I call gaslighting gifts. You know, they're nothing to do with me. They're all about the way she wants to present herself to me in books that I would never read and things like that. So yeah, I've been no contact with her for a few years. And my father, I had kind of held on to because he was less nefarious. Like I said, he was more the emotionally neglectful kind. But I started to realize that he too really had been kind of scapegoating me. And after my divorce, he had decided that I broke up the whole family. And there was just this sense that he didn't have any respect or any care for me. And finally, the last time I went to see him, I had this feeling like, why am I going? I was in the car driving there and thinking, why am I doing this? Like, I've really worked hard to be really authentic in my life and to have authentic relationships. What am I doing? Am I just going to go and sit there and bide my time for 90 minutes so I can say that I visited my father? And so when I got there, I just started speaking just very honestly and candidly. And it didn't go over well, of course. And then finally, I said to him, do you want a relationship with me? And he said, no. And so that was kind of like, okay. And in the same way that you said things kind of come up when you're ready for them, I think I was ready to hear that because I knew that was true, but I had never asked. And I think it didn't devastate me. It kind of just made things make sense, you know? And so I told him, I'm going to leave the ball in your court. And I never really got anything from him since then. I think I got a card that said, even though we don't see eye to eye, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I actually addressed it and I emailed him and I said, you know, sending me a note that says, this is because we see things differently as a form of gaslighting and I don't accept it. And I kind of gave a little synopsis of the way I felt I'd been treated throughout my life by him. And I said, I'm not letting you off the hook. And I've heard nothing.
How did that feel?
It felt okay. It felt like I told the truth. And the disappointing thing is that he didn't reply. And I think the little girl in me is always trying to get my father's attention. And so I was still hoping for a reply and I didn't get one.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when you mentioned, you know, with your mother, how she would, you know, disown you and then act as if nothing ever happened. I mean, God, that was the scene in my family growing up, right? Like chaos followed by the next day as if nothing ever happened.
Yeah.
And I think, and I found myself doing that a lot with my dad too, like having him just blow up at me. And then after some time would pass, just him acting as if nothing happened. And then me just kind of giving him the benefit of the doubt and like sweeping it under the rug. But then I just realized that like, I just kept putting myself in a position to be hurt. And I think it's so hard because we all just have this fantasy that like one day our parent is going to be the parent that we've always so desperately hoped that they would be.
It's so true, Andrea. That is so true. And then there's also the issue of sunk cost, you know, like I think about all the years I wasted trying to forge a relationship with him. And it made me think, I wish I had done this 10 years ago. But at the same time, I have to trust that everything happens when it's supposed to happen.
Yeah, in divine timing.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. How have you dealt with the anger? Like, do you feel like you've found a place of forgiveness for your parents?
Yeah, surprisingly, I think I have. And it came very naturally. You know, I've just lost the resentment I think for me, I don't know the definition of forgiveness, but I think it has to do with losing the feeling of resentment.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it really has to be an active thing where you say, I forgive you. You certainly don't have to tell them. But I do feel I've reached a place of forgiveness simply because I don't care that much anymore. You know, like I just feel like I've totally let go of wanting their attention, wanting their love. I feel like it's none of my business anymore. And I just want to go on and live the life that I deserve, you know?
Mm-hmm. So when you're working with a client one-on-one, and let's say that they are engaging in some sort of self-sabotaging behavior, but they're not really quite able to connect what is the underlying root. How are you kind of helping them suss that out?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how many people don't know that their self-sabotage is actually self-protection that they learned as a child. So what we do is what's called inner child work or inner child healing, and just learning that the ways that you're sabotaging yourself are actually the ways that your inner child is trying to keep you safe. And I really encourage people to, instead of criticizing that inner child, which is what we always do, we say, why are you doing that? Stop doing that. You shouldn't do that. And instead, thank the inner child for trying to keep you safe, you know, thank the inner child for trying to protect you the best way that they could. And then when you have that, when you take away the criticism and the pushing down the inner child, you might find that the child now wants to do what children are supposed to do. So instead of having this burden of trying to protect you, they become the one who wants to get curious about life and play and explore. And all the things that life is really about that we've been denied, you know, because when you're in that survival brain, you're not thinking about play and curiosity and exploring what the world has to offer. You're just in this little tunnel, you know, and so that inner child work can really expand what's possible for you and make life fun again, you know?
Yeah, that really brings up some things for me. This whole year has been like a struggle for me to, there's like just always this fear that I'm going to like self-sabotage,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I'm just going to fuck it all up. And, I realize, you know, the way that I stayed safe and the way that I saved my family was by being the fuck up.
Right.
You know, like I was the identified patient,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was the scapegoat, and that helped my mom to stop drinking as much and my parents stop fighting, and just realizing still how there's that part of me that thinks that if I'm doing well, that means then my family's not going to do well.
Wow. That's an amazing insight. That is such a powerful insight. And I really think that you just even knowing that is so powerful. To me, that's the key, really.
So what are your, when you're working one-on-one with a client, do you feel like, this is my opinion, I think it's really hard to really do the healing work on ourselves if we're actively involved in a very abusive or toxic relationship with our parents. Like, I think mm-hmm. it's kind of sort of like dating, that where we need to take this time to work, be single, and like really focus on ourselves and do that healing work. And then obviously there's more to be healed and resolved, like as we dip our toe back into the dating pond. And I think the same can be said for, as it relates to like our relationship with our parents, that it's really hard to navigate our own healing if we're continuing to engage in an abusive relationship with them. And perhaps one day we will get to a place where we've kind of, you know, healed enough or healed some parts of us that we're able to try to figure out and navigate that relationship in a way that works for us. Or maybe we find out that we can't, but I think it's really hard to heal if we're continuing to be hurt.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to heal if you keep the things in your life that are hurting you the same as they've always been. We have to change, right? And a lot of that is changing relationships. And that doesn't have to mean detaching or going no contact, but the nature of the relationship has to change, right? And so I find what happens is part of the program that I go through with my clients is to do with accepting the limitations of other people. So I don't tell anybody whether they should keep a relationship or whether they should leave. But what I've found is that when they begin focusing on themselves and their own needs, those relationships tend to change on their own. And if they don't, they might go away. You know, they might have to end. So like you said, the work is on yourself. And out of that comes the confidence, the boundaries, all that good stuff that establish what you're willing to put up with in a relationship. And then, you know, the people who can't tolerate that, they may not have a place in your life, or they may have a different place. And I can say one of my clients was married to someone who was very emotionally abusive. And it was frustrating to me because part of me was like, why are you with this person? But through doing the work and through teaching her to turn the gaze on herself, think about her own needs instead of fretting over the fact that he's doing what he's always done, which is not trying to meet your needs, he did change. Like she said, he's been defending me to my daughters. He's been on my side. And all those years of her begging him to pay attention to her and begging him to, you know, see her didn't have any effect. But once she started to give that to herself, that's when the relationship started to change. So I'm really a big advocate of meeting your own needs as an adult rather than especially looking to the same people that you know have never done that for you, you know, like our parents and so on. And I've been there. I know that feeling of wanting these people to change, but the likelihood is that they're not going to, and you have to accept that. And if you don't want to accept it, you have to think about changing the relationship.
How has this healing and transformation impacted your relationship with your kids?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I'm divorced. So I've always had to co-parent with my ex, and he's made it kind of difficult. And that was another thing that...
Shocking.
Yeah, that was another thing that I had to learn about that I didn't know, is that he was doing this parental alienation thing. So he was really encouraging the kids to keep secrets from me. And when they were with me, he would always call. And I remember, you know, our spidey senses are often right. And I would think, does he always call when they're here, like every day or twice a day? And then I found out through just reading something that that's a form of parental alienation. So it's trying to drive a wedge between you and the kids rather than just give you the time alone with them, you know? So I really learned that when my stomach says something's wrong, usually something is wrong, you know? And so with my kids, it's
been interesting. Well, let's pause there because yeah. I think that's probably something that I'm sure that there's a lot of, you know, people listening out there that are co-parenting that are probably in a toxic dynamic like that. Yeah. So how did you handle that situation?
You know, I handled it the best way I could because at the time I didn't have all the knowledge that I have now. And I was really, at first, I was trying to appease him, thinking that, you know, kind of if I give him what he wants, then he'll back off. But what I've learned is that bullies, when you give them what they want, they just want more, you know, like they just kind of, the goalpost keeps changing, right? So,
knowing what you know now, what advice would you have given to yourself back then?
I would say I would have stood up to him 100% and I would have advocated for myself, and I would have got support for advocating for myself in the form of a lawyer earlier. I ended up doing that finally near the end, but I would have I would have enlisted support instead of trying to do this myself, especially with going through getting sober and all that stuff. You know, I just, because I was so used to going through things on my own, I don't think I really took advantage of the supports that were available to me. So I would say, you know, it wasn't really a fair fight. He's much richer and more powerful than I was and all of that stuff. So yeah, that's what I would say, is just don't ever think that you can appease someone like that. Stand up for yourself, like learn how to get support, read up on things, read about, you know, narcissistic exes if you need to, and don't do it alone. That's what I would say.
I think that for a lot of parents, it's hard when they're kind of coming to terms with their childhood trauma and realizing how often, you know, we treat our kids or put them in same positions that we were put in as kids. And so what was that like for you?
Yeah, I would say that I did that without realizing it, because as my children became adults, as they got into the older teenage years, we had kind of a rupture and repair situation. So I didn't realize that they hadn't really felt free to be honest with me about how they felt, that they were kind of telling me what they thought I wanted to hear. And then eventually, you know, things came out and they were finally honest with me. And when that happened, it really gave me a chance to look at myself and say, like, wow, you know, this, you weren't so perfect at this as you thought you were. You didn't do such a great job as you thought you did. And you have some amends to make to these kids, you know? And so I did make the amends to them. I did tell them that I was sorry that they didn't feel like they could be honest with me. And this shows the beauty of when you take that, you know, whereas maybe your parents or my parents for sure would take that criticism as a reason to disown you. The fact that I could take that criticism and repair the relationship was such a gift. And so we're not perfect still, but our relationship is much more honest, and they want to see me now, you know, and it's just real. And I'm so glad that we had that chance to get real with each other instead of going on with them feeling like they couldn't really tell me everything, you know.
What a gift.
Yeah, it really was. And that was the gift that our parents, you and I, they don't have, you know, because they're too scared of that repair.
Yeah, they're just not capable. Yeah, I know. Yeah, we are so lucky. We have this
absolutely
heal. So talk about this workshop thing that you got coming up.
Oh yeah, I've got a retreat that's coming up at the end of February. It's going to be February 21st to 23rd, and I'm happy to say that you're going to be a speaker. It's a multi-speaker event. So I've got about 14 speakers lined up.
Nice.
And yeah, and it's going to go over the course of 3 days. And the videos will be about 25 to 35 minutes long. You'll have the day to watch them. And it's called the Dysfunctional Family Detox. So it's all about overcoming these toxic family dynamics that we've been discussing today.
And you'll be fixed in 3 days after watching all of them?
I hope you will get some tools that you can use on your healing journey for sure. And I hope that you will feel less alone, you know, that you'll just have this chance to be around people who are going through the same thing as you and find out how they dealt with it.
Is there going to be like a, is there like an interactive part to it?
Yeah, there'll be a Facebook group.
Oh, nice. Yeah, is this your first time doing something like this?
No, I did one last year that went really well. It was called the Reparenting Yourself Retreat. So it was a similar theme, but I've decided to really focus on the dysfunctional family dynamics this time. But it went really well last year, and that's why I decided to do another one. I got a lot of great feedback.
That's what your course is called, right? Is it self-parenting or reparenting?
The self-parenting solution is what I call it.
And how long of a program is that?
That is pretty short. It's eight lessons, but they're very bite-sized. You could do them in as little as 20 minutes. But there's implementation, so I kind of give steps at the end of each lesson that you can take with you over the course of the next week and kind of make sure you implement this stuff into your life. Excuse me. So that one is online. It's very easy to access. It's a really low price point. And it just goes through many of the issues like negative self-talk, setting boundaries, toxic people, just dealing with all the things that can be difficult for us when we've grown up with these unmet childhood needs. So learning to reparent the inner child, basically.
At the beginning of this work, I thought all of this stuff was like pretty corny. Like reparenting sounded so corny to me. Inner child, that's something that's like kind of taken me a little while to like come on board with. And I think what I've realized, and I was talking to my therapist about it, was I think part of the reason it was so hard for me to connect with that inner child, or I had the resistance in going there, is because I didn't feel like a child when I was a child. I felt like a little adult.
Yes. And that's one thing too, is that you hear a lot of people say, like self-help experts will say, if you want to reclaim your joy, think about what you did when you were a child. When you were a child, you were playful and
You're
you
like,
didn't
no, when
care.
I was a
It's
child,
like,
things fucking sucked. I was miserable.
yeah, I
I
don't
was cleaning
remember
toilets.
any of that when I was a child. So you're speaking to the wrong person. And I think a lot of us feel like that, like, no, childhood was not joyful for me. And so you have to go even farther back, like maybe to when you were a toddler or a baby, to find who you were before all these things kind of got their clutches in you.
So what would be a good baby step for someone to like just start connecting with that inner child?
Yeah, I would say just even spend the day with it. Like, think
What does that
about
look like?
take your child out for ice cream, take your child to the arcade. Like, just go and do something that is fun for you, and maybe you don't know yet what's fun for you, but this is the time to start to recognize that. So you can make a list of things that you love to do. You can use your senses as a guide. So think about what you like to listen to, see, smell, touch, taste. Use those to guide you. And then just go out there and get it.
Go out there and get it.
Yeah, that's it. Do a date. I'd say that's the first thing. Just be nice to yourself.
What's fun for your inner child?
You know what? Fun for my inner child is solitary activities. I used to love doing things like playing with Barbies, rug hooking, paper dolls. So I still like that. I don't play with Barbies, but I like doing things that are solitary. Like, I remember when I was doing this inner child work at first, I went and bought rug hooking kits and I just started doing them. And it's very meditative and it reminded me of things that, like, it helped me connect with myself again, because I think a lot of us have trouble. We often don't have hobbies. We often don't have things we do just for fun. And a lot of that is the inability to relax, or it could be the feeling, inside that we don't deserve it. We've always got to be proving our worth. So even just doing things that you enjoy can be the work.
What the hell is rug hooking?
I'll send you a picture of it.
It's like crocheting? It's like
It's
that?
so simple. It's so simple that any child can do it. You just have this kind of grid pattern with a picture on it and different colors, and
Oh,
then you have little
yeah.
pieces of wool and a
Yeah.
tulle that you attach. And so with the different colors, you just kind of attach this wool to create this picture. Very easy.
Rug hooking.
Yeah.
Well, this has been great. Where can you be found if you want to be found?
Yeah, I think probably the best place to find me would be on Instagram, and that's at Laura K. Connell. And you could go to the link.
Don't
in my
forget that
bio.
K.
Yeah, that's it. It follows me around now.
What does it
and
stand
everything,
for?
It's Kim. It stands for Kim. Yeah. And so everything about me is there. If you like what you see there, you'll resonate with my work. And feel free to DM me too and let me know that you found me through Andrea's podcast, and I'd be happy to chat.
Yeah, and let her know if you're a fellow rug hugging gal.
Yes, and if you know what that is. Yeah.
Well, thanks. This has been great.
Yeah, thanks, Andrea. Don't let it all go.